So when I was a youth minister, we would often do group building exercises, and sometimes we would go on retreats, and that would be all we would do was just all group building exercises. And one of the ones that I enjoyed, I'm not sure that everybody did, was the trust fall. How many here have ever done a trust fall? Oh, quite a few of you. Okay. So you know that this is just to help those of you who've never seen this done or never done it. In a trust fall, one brave person gets up and they don't stand on the piano, but they stand about this high up. And everyone else in the group then lines up across from each other in the same way you see that picture, and you put your hands out. And the person standing there puts their arms across their chest, and as you see, they fall back, trusting that they're going to be caught by the people standing there. Now, what I experienced when we did those trust falls is that those were moments that were growing moments for individuals, but they were also growing moments for the group, because what happened in that trust fall is that bonds were built and intimacy created. Because you see, when we trust, trusting results in intimacy. So I want to point out that what Jesus says here at the beginning of this portion of John's gospel that Sherry read for us today, he speaks of trust. He says to the disciples here at the beginning of this 14th chapter, don't be troubled. Trust God. Trust me. In my Father's house, there's room to spare. Now, this passage, I've often read this at funerals and memorial services. It's one of those that's suggested when you're planning a funeral or memorial service. And I think it's because for many people, this offers word of comfort. We see in this perhaps a visual of what heaven is like. Heaven is like a big, big house, in the words of Stephen Curtis Chapman. A big, big house with lots and lots of room, with a big, big table and lots of food, and a big backyard where we can play football, yes. So for some people, that's what they think is happening here. Jesus is saying this is what heaven is going to look like, a big house. But I think it's really important for us to know both the context of these words from Jesus and who the first audience is besides the disciples. Who first hears this story? So these words from Jesus come in the middle of what's come to be known as the final discourse. Jesus' last will and testament, his last words to the disciple, his last teachings for the disciples. And these words were first heard by a community that had gathered around John, sometimes called the Johannine community, probably sometime in the latter half of the first century. They were the first to hear this because these words, you may have noticed, are not in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. And what was going on for this Johannine community was they were in a time of distress. They were Jews who had decided that they were going to be Jesus' followers because they believed that Jesus was the Messiah. And as a result of that, they had been thrown out of the synagogue. So they no longer had a faith home, the place where they went and gathered with others who were followers of the one true God. They no longer had a home. And John knows this. John knows this about his community. And as this is happening, and he knows that they're sort of feeling like orphans at this point, he remembers this story. And he wants to make sure they know this story. This story of Jesus' last night, Jesus' last meal with the disciples. Now, the disciples didn't know that this was the last, but Jesus knew. They'd come together to celebrate the Passover meal. And you may know that the Passover meal is a great celebration for the Jews. There's lots of food and drink. There's lots of laughing and storytelling and games. There's a really energized, celebratory aspect to gathering for the Passover meal. And I'm sure that had happened for Jesus and the disciples because that's what they were used to. But then when the meal was over, the tone began to shift, because when the meal was over, Jesus got up from the table, took off his outer garment, his shirt, wrapped a towel around his waist, picked up a basin and water, and moved around the room washing the disciples' feet. Now, if you know this story, you know teachers did not do this for their followers. Persons of any rank or importance did not do this. And so this was confusing and troubling for the disciples. And Peter even protested and said, "You're not going to wash my feet." And then when Jesus tells him, "This is what's happening here. I'm modeling for you. And if I don't wash your feet, then you can't have any part of this." Well, then Peter does what Peter does. He just goes and says, "Well, wash all of me then." It was confusing. They didn't know what was happening. It was a little troubling. And things got even more troubling when Jesus, after he was done, began talking about betrayal. And then Judas, one of their own, got up and left the table, left the room after Jesus handed him a piece of bread. And then Jesus told Peter that he was going to deny him. And then he began to talk about leaving and that they couldn't go with him. And they didn't know what to do with that. "Where are you going? Why can't we go with you? We're committed to be with you wherever you go. Why can't we go? Where are you going? I don't understand what's happening." It was like the ground was shifting beneath their feet. John remembered that, remembered what it was like to feel like you don't know what's up, what's down. And he remembered how Jesus responded with love and compassion and mercy. "Don't let this throw you. Trust God. Trust me. In my Father's house, there's room to spare." Now, for the ancient Israelites, when you talked about my Father's house, you were talking about family. You were talking about who you were and where your identity was. Talking about family. And Jesus is saying, "In my family, there's room for you." In those years when I was a youth minister, I was single. Now, my family didn't live far away. My parents were in Denton. My brothers were nearby. But on Sundays, it was sort of an odd day for me sometimes, because, you know, we'd have worship and Sunday school all morning long. And the church where I served, we didn't do meetings after church. Everybody went and did lunch. And sometimes that was just weird for me, because there wasn't anybody necessarily for me to go and eat lunch with. But then into the youth group came the Harris family, Jessica and Mary and Emma, all teenagers, and their parents, Harvey and Sharon. And they noticed that I didn't really have a place to go. And so they invited me home with them. "Come on, come home, have dinner with us today." Now, they were very busy people. Harvey at the time was a researcher at Southwestern Medical School, and Sharon was an AP English teacher at Newman Smith High School, and their girls were busy, busy teenagers. And their house was a typical house with a family, not big, but with lots of books everywhere and papers everywhere, and sometimes kind of cluttered with the lives of their girls, and it wasn't neat and tidy. But they would say to me, "No, come on, come on, your family, come on." And they did it enough, I began to believe them, so that by the time I left, I really felt like I was family with the Harrises. I still feel that way. The girls are now grown, have their own children. Sharon's a widow now, but they're still family because they invited me into that space. That's what Jesus is doing here for the disciples. He's inviting them into that family space and saying, "Because of me, you're adopted into my family, my Father's house." It's not just for the disciples, but it's for John's community and for us as well. And that's good news for anyone who's ever felt like they've been thrown out or rejected or set aside. What Jesus is saying here is that in my family, there's a room for you. There's a place for you. Through Jesus Christ, we know the intimacy of God as Father. Now, Philip's response to all this is sort of interesting. He says, show us the Father. And John doesn't write this, but really what there should be in the story is sort of a collective gasp around the room, because this is a really, really presumptuous request. Good Jews knew that human beings cannot see God and live. There's this wonderful story in the book of Exodus where Moses, who was the closest to God that anybody ever got, says, let me see you. And God says, listen, you can't take that, but here's what I'll do. I will hide you in this cleft in the rock, and I'll pass by, and after I pass by, you look out and you can see my sandal going away. Good Jews knew that God is too holy, too infinite, too powerful, too full of future and possibility for human beings to be in the presence of and live. And so Philip asking this question is audacious and bold and impudent. And Jesus responds with grace and mercy and love, saying, listen, you've been with me this whole time. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you know me, you know the Father. My whole reason for being here is to help you to see God not as vague, obscure, distant other, but instead as vulnerable, by your side, intimate, welcoming friend. Now, this was countercultural. It was counterintuitive for the disciples, because Jews saw God as distant other, who from the mountaintop gave them all these rules that helped them to know who was doing it right and who was doing it wrong, who was in and who was out. And when you know who's in and who's out, then you're secure. You know where you stand. And that's sort of what happened for the Johannine community. They weren't doing it the way it was supposed to be done, and so they got pushed out. And you know, we live in a time when there's an awful lot of energy being spent on who's in and who's out, what separates us, what divides us. There's an awful lot of energy being spent on coming up with ways to make sure that those who are outside know that they're supposed to stay outside, so that those who are inside can feel safe and secure. But I've been reminded this week that Paul says in the letter to the Romans, the 15th chapter, the 7th verse, welcome others in the same way that you have been welcomed by Christ. There's room to spare. On this Mother's Day, I've been thinking about my friend Amy Cook Meeker. Amy and her husband Bob went through fertility treatments, and it was a struggle, and she told me yesterday, we just knew we were never going to have children. It just wasn't working. And then what sometimes happens, happened for them, and a pregnancy happened surprisingly and carried to term, and Molly was born. And they thought, oh, we were done. But about, I think maybe a year and a half later, maybe 2 years later, they were at an event at their church that was about adoption and about foster care, and particularly about adoption internationally. And Amy saw a picture of a 13-month-old Korean boy. And she says, I'm not one that I hear the voice of God, but in that moment, God spoke to me and said, this is your son. And so they began to investigate. They found out that he was in an orphanage in Korea, and that he was available, what had been available for adoption, but another family had locked his file, which means that they had said, this is the child we want. We don't want anybody else to, so we're going to do all the work we need to do to internationally adopt him. But they also learned that there was some concern at that point that he had a condition that could lead potentially to pretty serious congenital cognitive problems later on. And when the family who had locked the file found this out, they said, well, no, we don't think we can handle that. And so the adoption agency turned to Amy and Bob, and Amy and Bob said, yes. And just before he turned two, they brought their son Timmy home. He does not have the cognitive problems. He did come home and have to have a 10-hour heart surgery, but he's very healthy now, very healthy, active, 7-year-old little boy. But they weren't done. Amy then saw Savannah Joy on another adoption website. Ian, if you'll go ahead and show her picture. Savannah was in China. And Savannah has some cognitive issues, but they brought her home. And they also saw Kelsey Kate. Kelsey also has cognitive issues. Both of the girls receive special care through the Carrollton Farmers Branch School District. They're both now 7 years old. Amy also saw Emily. Now, Emily has profound needs. She can't see. She can't hear. She can't walk. They're not really even sure what she comprehends. She receives extensive special education through Carrollton Farmers Branch ISD. She's 9 years old. They really thought they were done at that point. But 4 years ago, Amy had seen this picture. Go ahead and show the next one. This is Lovey Dovey. She also is in China, was in China, and was born with spina bifida. She was in foster care, and while she was in foster care, she was abused physically pretty severely, resulting in a traumatic brain injury. In January, Amy and Bob found out that Lovey Dovey was available for adoption, and Amy had always known this was her daughter, and so they brought her home. This is what Isabel Lovey Dovey looks like now. You can go ahead and show the next one, Ian. She's 7 years old. They found out since they brought her home, she has 50% function in her kidneys. They don't know exactly what that's going to mean long term. But what all of this means is that this couple who thought they would never have children have six in a 1,700 square foot house in Dallas. Two of them are nine, four of them are seven. Four of them have pretty severe needs. And all of the paraphernalia that goes along with that, wheelchairs and feeding tubes and catheters and special bikes and special helmets. But Amy and Bob Meeker's home is a here on earth expression of the good news that's here in the Gospel of John. That in our Father's house there is room to spare for you and for me, and especially for anyone who has ever heard no. May we be like Amy and Bob and be those who welcome others as Christ has welcomed us. Glory to God.